Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today we're focusing on citrus with My Ag Life in Citrus.
My Ag Life in Citrus is brought to you by Soil and Crop Incorporated, your number one resource for sustainable crop nutrition by putting nature to work for you.
We start today on the topic of labor. Our guest for this segment is Rudy Mendoza, Executive Director of the California Ag Labor Association.
So to start off with, things are obviously heating up around the state's growing regions weather-wise. So let's talk about what do employers need to be thinking about now as we head into the, you know, notoriously hot summer months for their employees.
Well, there's never a wrong time to talk about heat illness prevention. Unfortunately, historically in agriculture, we kind of wait to the last minute to start doing the training, but the Department of Industrial Relations, dir.ca.gov, has a great set of resources. And the training itself is broken down into four components, which is the training, the water element, shade, and planting. And so right now, it's very important for folks to be able to receive the necessary information on how to prevent heat illness or heat stroke symptoms from ever occurring. But it's always a good time. There's never a wrong time. And definitely right now, we should be doing a lot of this training.
And it is something that we, you know, talk about, of course, every year as we head into summer. And the rules kind of never change as far as what we need to do to prevent heat stroke or to keep workers healthy as they're working. But what are some things that you do suggest employers think about?
Well, planting is a field, and you know you're going to be working anywhere past 80, 90 degrees, which is very typical this time of year. Then you need to make sure that you have enough provisions for water. Unfortunately, in ag, a lot of us forget that the standard actually requires a specific minimum amount of water. And that is 1 quart per hour for every person for every hour of work. So it's a little bit of math that you have to do, but basically for a 30-person crew, you have to maintain at least 7.5 gallons of water every hour on the hour. So typically a crew will go out and they'll take a 10-gallon igloo and in the morning, and that's what they start off with. But once that water starts dwindling down to less than 7.5 gallons, there needs to be provisions for replenishment. And so we always encourage our members to take out plenty of water or have a plan for replenishment, whether it's having somebody come out and replenish fresh water or sending somebody to go acquire that water, but having a plan, and that plan that actually needs to be written down as part of the heat illness prevention program for the employer. But water is a big one, and shade structures are also very important. In order to have adequate shade, you have to make sure that you have enough to cover every member of the crew in the event of a unlikely emergency that you have to take everybody out at the same time. But that provision actually requires you to have shade up and standing by the time temperatures rise to 80 degrees or above. And so that is something that, unfortunately, you know, we still have a hard time getting people to be prepared for, because the temperatures might be 80 degrees and the shade structure, while present, it still hasn't been propped up. And so it needs to be propped up.
And as you said, that starts at 80 degrees. So that those are things that we've had several days already that should have been, we should have had shade out there already.
Absolutely. And the actual standard says that while the temperature may not necessarily be at 80 degrees, shade structure needs to be available. So the shade structure, there isn't any reason why crews should not be carrying shade structures throughout the entire year. So regardless of the temperature, they should always have it in their possession. But definitely once that temperature hits 80 degrees, it better be propped up. Otherwise, you're in violation of the standard.
Right. And, you know, and just from a human standpoint too, that shade is so important because it can knock the temperature down by several degrees, especially when we have such a hot day. Like you said, it's something easy enough to carry around to have available. You know, let me ask you this. if the rules aren't followed for whatever reason, if a shade is forgotten or if the water's not replenished in time, who is actually responsible or who would face the penalties should that happen?
Well, ultimately, the burden falls on the employer. In this case, we're talking about farm labor contractors. However, under the new rules, which came into effect just a few years ago, the joint employer liability regulations, the burden can be shared across the board, not only between the contractor, but also the contractor, the grower, potentially the packing shed that actually hired these folks. So it just really depends on how aggressive the person that's out there, the agent from the state or whoever is doing the inspection, how aggressive they want to get and pursue this. But it's very likely that they can hold everybody accountable. But first and foremost, it is the employer, it is the contractor.
And then, our primary audience is the ag industry in California. We've got a lot of growers listening, but this goes out over the internet. So we have a lot of other people who tune in and listen too. And so I just want to explain a couple of things for those listeners as well, because often when people in other states think about California, they think of the beach, they think it's 75 degrees and beautiful, and maybe don't understand exactly how hot it gets in many of our growing regions and how dangerous that can be. Can you give us some examples?
Well, absolutely. The ag industry in particular actually has some additional requirements as part of heat illness prevention, which is what are called the high heat standards. So there's additional provisions that need to be taken into account, which is also additional monitoring and training. So for example, if the crews will be working out in temperatures in excess of 95 degrees, then there needs to be a morning startup meeting every day that crew will be out working under those specific temperature conditions. So again, those high heat procedures only apply to agriculture, construction, landscaping, the oil and gas extraction industries, and transportation or delivery of ag, construction materials, or other heavy materials. So those elements, again, are ensuring that you have an effective communication system, that employees are actually observed for alertness and signs or symptoms of heat illness. So supervisors or their designees needs to be able to observe one supervisor buddy system that's required when the temperatures are above 95 degrees and you're out working in those elements. Regular communications, that means that every morning there needs to be some sort of a startup meeting to discuss, hey, today it's going to be this hot, and remind you to take water and shade, and then also remind people what to look for in terms of the symptoms. But there are those extra provisions, and they do need to be documented. So one thing that we always stress in our organization is when you provide those trainings or you're working in those conditions, make sure that you document that everybody received that 10 or 15 minute tailgate, reminding folks about the importance of drinking water. And as funny as it may sound, it is actually a requirement that folks are reminded throughout the shift to make sure that they drink plenty of water. And first and foremost, it's also important that crews receive a 10 minute break every 2 hours. Again, once those temperatures exceed 95 degrees or higher.
All right, that is important information. Make sure you document, make sure you're reminding them. Are there any posting requirements or any signs that are required for this?
Absolutely. So part of a good, effective, and good communication system is, not only talking to people, but actually having things that are visual for employees to remind them. So, one of the things that we do in our organization is we provide a lot of resources, whether it's pamphlets, brochures, training cards, posters. We also have some really neat bumper stickers that are actually applied to the ladders that our farm labor contractor crews use. And it's reminding them that, only you can prevent heat illness and it's reminding them that it's water, taking a break, and using shade as needed. And so absolutely, there are a lot of things that you can use, and it's never a bad idea to give somebody something. If you do a training, give them a reminder card or a poster or a pamphlet which has visual images of the symptoms that they should be looking for. So whether it's headaches, dizziness, muscular cramps, nausea, there's a whole list of these things, and it's always a good thing. But I do also want to stress that as part of the training, it's important to remind employees of how important it is to take care of yourself. You also have a vested interest as an employee, but the ability to take care of yourself starts with what you consume and what you drink throughout the day. So we want to see them drinking water. Drinks such as Gatorade are important, but water is key. Unfortunately, we still see a lot of employees that drink a lot of sodas or caffeine drinks, especially those drinks that are high in caffeine and sugar, such as Monster and Red Bull and Full Throttle. And we remind employees every day that, you know, those things tend to dehydrate you quicker. And while you may get a quick high, the drop on the way down is what's going to make you sick. So education is key.
Right. That is a very good point, to make sure that it's water that you're drinking. And those energy drinks can be very dangerous when you're out in the heat and working and maybe not realizing how dehydrated you get. From what I understand, too, when you are suffering from heat illness or dehydration, the early signs can be very easy to miss and very easy to ignore. And then you get into further trouble because you're not immediately taking some action on that. Is that why the reminders every hour to drink your water?
Well, that in conjunction with the supervisor actually monitoring. And again, part of the buddy system is so that if I'm working alongside my buddy, then we're monitoring each other. So it's a constant reminder that, you know, if I'm working with Joe and I know Joe, I've worked with him for a long time and I know his personality, but all of a sudden today he's maybe a little lethargic, or he seems to be not walking quite straight and maybe complaining of headaches. And I know that those are symptoms that I need to either question him or alert my supervisor on. One of the things that we do here at CALA is we provide supervisor training at least once a year for all of our supervisors. We provide them with all the training information and the resources, but sometimes we may even end up doing it twice a year or two or three times a year, depending on how often they want to take it. But it's going through the standard and talking about what to look for. But I also want to make sure that folks understand that if you have a labor crew out there, your foreman or at least somebody in that crew needs to be trained in CPR first aid. And that's actually a standard. The standard says that anytime you have a crew of 20 or more people, you have to have somebody in CPR first aid trained capacity. And so we're also qualified instructors here at CALA, and we provide that training, and we emphasize wholeheartedly heat illness prevention and the symptoms that are
Is there anything else that you think that we should be discussing as far as the heat goes and what growers or employers, need to know?
Well, the CalOSHA requires that every employer have a written heat illness prevention procedure program or policy. And unfortunately, what happens is some employers, what they do is they will take a sample document off the internet and put it in binders somewhere and think that they are now in compliance. Unfortunately, that is not the case. This policy needs to be very specific as to what an employer will do to prevent heat illness in the workplace. And if you do not have any training in this type of area, we would be happy to provide that to you. Again, the other part of it is what you have written as part of your procedures is what you should be following in the field as well. So if you have a 5 or 6 page document and you are not following any of the procedures that you have in this document, then you again will be in violation because you have something that doesn't go along with what you're actually doing in the field. So paying attention to policy and procedural documents is very important. We can tailor make something for your organization. We'd be happy to work with you in doing the training for your employees, whether it's your supervisors or your actual harvesters. But again, planning, training, water, shade, those are all things that are very important. And last but not least, I do want to remind folks that the imminent hazards besides folks just getting sick in the field, which is obviously very important to prevent, also includes receiving what could potentially be an OPU. And you never want to get an OPU. An OPU is an order prohibiting use. And why that's so significant is if an agent of the state comes out and finds that you're in violation of any of the heat illness prevention standards, then what they will do is they will potentially shut down the entire operation. So let's say, for example, you have six crews out everywhere in the valley working today, and this agent only happens upon one crew. That agent can issue an OPU, which means that the employer now has to shut down all operations across the company. And work will not be allowed to resume until the employer can demonstrate that the imminent hazards have been corrected. That does not include the monetary penalties that OSHA can also impart on the employer. But if you would like any more information on how to prevent heat illness and what you can do to have a better trained workforce, please give us a call at CALA. Our number is 559-372-2822. And our staff is fully bilingual. We are actually in the field more than we are in the office. So we do a lot of training in the field.
Thank you again to Rudy Mendoza. Our news brief is up next. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Your news brief for today. California giant Berry Farms and 1.1 announced their strategic partnership aimed at increasing berry output and availability through vertical farming and data-driven berry cultivation. Silicon Valley-based 1.1 has developed revolutionary automated indoor vertical farming technology that offers superior product yields and quality, they say, while also enabling crops to be grown closer to the end consumer. Through this partnership, California Giant will share its expertise with 1.1 and together collaborate on data and research that will ultimately result in strawberries that meet California Giant's rigorous quality standards. To start, the partnership will focus on developing an exclusive strawberry cultivar. With California Giant's participation and data, 1.1 will grow the berries in its automated aeroponic vertical wall indoor farm. The outcomes learned within the indoor data-rich setting will then be shared with California Giant's greater operations and applied to traditional field-grown techniques in the future. The vertical farming structures are currently located in California and Arizona, with the goal of expanding them throughout the country to improve the availability and accessibility of fresh berries. USDA says it will convey farmer concerns on federal rules like Waters of the U.S. Here's Stephanie Ho.
USDA will have input in federal efforts that affect agricultural producers.
When you're talking about issues like Waters of the U.S., we want to make sure at all times that when decisions are made by partnering agencies that could adversely affect
our farmers and ranchers that we want to be at the table, and we are always at the table.
Deputy Agriculture Secretary Jule Brenaugh referred to the rule that is being handled by the Environmental Protection Agency.
I read about the article, of course, this morning, and there's a lot to discuss around waters of the U.S. as we go forward.
She added that she has regular meetings with her counterparts in other agencies.
And one thing that Secretary Vilsack has said to me is, do not be afraid to speak up. So I see it in my role that when decisions are made that adversely affect American agriculture, it is my job to speak up.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The California Department of Food and Agriculture recently released the California Agricultural Organic Report for 2019-2020. It shows that California accounts for 40% of all organic production in the U.S. Between 2014 and 2019, organic production increased 44%. In 2019, sales of organic products in California totaled more than $10.4 billion. That is an increase of 3.5% from 2018. And California land for organic production in 2019 included 2,590,328 acres. Operation types registered with CDFA's state organic program in 2019 were 5,452 producers, 1,295 handlers, and 216 processors. Drought is still maintaining a strong hold on most farming areas of Brazil. Gary Crawford has more.
If somebody were to tell me this was the worst drought in almost 100 years, I would tend to believe them.
That's USDA meteorologist Mark Brusberg, and he's not talking about drought here in the U.S., but rather the ongoing drought in Brazil.
I don't think any part of Brazil had what they would consider a normal year.
Not when it comes to farming and agriculture. Now, Brazil's a huge country, but they have had drought problems in just about every major farming area. And so
we're continuously assessing and revising our production figures for things like soybeans, corn, and cotton.
Especially corn. Last month, USDA analysts dropped their forecast for Brazil's corn crop by about 6%. By the time you hear this, USDA will have made a fresh projection for the Brazilian corn crop. That projection had not been made before we had to go to press with this story. Now, the corn that we're talking about here is the type used to feed livestock, so it's not generally for human food. But the lack of rain in Brazil is reportedly causing problems for some other crops, which are for direct human consumption.
We're starting to read about how the drought has impacted the coffee crop and the sugar crop grown in the southeast.
Could mean higher prices for consumers in Brazil and here in the U.S. But the drought in Brazil is not just affecting agriculture and food production. Brusberg says cities in Brazil with low water levels in their reservoirs could face limits on water use before the so-called rainy season returns in September. And speaking of the next rainy season, Mark says some of the problems with this past season may have been caused by La Niña, which is the above-normal cooling of waters in parts of the equatorial Pacific. La Niña sometimes produces weather patterns that bring drought to Brazil and Argentina. La Niña is gone for now, but
some of the models are leaning towards a second La Niña. And if there's a second La Niña, then perhaps there could be drought again. So that's something else that's on people's radar.
Drought, as we said, has already cut into this season's harvests, especially corn. South America competes, of course, with the U.S. in selling corn and other ag commodities on world markets. And Mark Brusberg says no farmer wishes a bad harvest to any other farmer anywhere. But, of course, if South American supplies are reduced,
that's an opportunity for us.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The U.S. Dairy Sustainability Awards program has a new class of 7 winners who demonstrate excellence in sustainability and contributions to the industry-wide 2050 environmental stewardship goals, as well as positive efforts in communities. Among the winners, a California partnership took the award for outstanding community impact. Calgrind Dairy Fuels has 22-plus miles of underground pipeline, which links 12 dairies that send biogas from on-farm digesters and 2 additional dairies that haul biomethane via tube trailers to its centralized conditioning facility in Pixley. An additional dairy supplies manure slurry to a digester at the Calgrind conditioning facility for biogas production. After upgrading this dairy biogas, Calgren injects it into a utility pipeline owned by Southern California Gas Company, the nation's largest natural gas distribution utility. The dairy-sourced renewable compressed natural gas is made available as fuel for heavy-duty trucks, replacing 3 million gallons of existing fossil fuel diesel with near-zero emissions from CNG engines. Each year, 150,000 tons of CO2 greenhouse gases are captured from more than 70,000 cows and heifers. Additionally, more than 75 full-time equivalent jobs have been supported, and another 18 miles of pipeline are under construction to add 10 more dairies to the cluster. That's your news brief for today. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The Citrus Research Board continues its webinar series this summer. Last week, they had a discussion on pest management and an industry update. There were two speakers featured. We start with Sonia Rios, the Area Subtropical Horticulture Advisor for Cooperative Extension Riverside County. Among other things, she talks about heat stress and the fire season, land prices and expenditures, and a course she's offering.
I just wanted to give you guys a heads up and just prepare yourselves for this heat wave. After looking at what CAL FIRE has been saying, and they're saying that this could be the worst fire season that they might see. That's due to, that's during these heat waves that we do have. So just be prepared for those. Stick close to the news, stick close to what you hear. You want to make sure that you're prepared for these heat waves. And sometimes in 2018, we had that unexpected 4-day heat wave that even reached 119 degrees in Valley Center, which is unheard of. But we want to make sure that we are prepared, and we want to make sure we watch those temperatures because they could soar above normal, and that could affect the stomata, that could affect the leaves on. Of course, you guys know that when a tree gets stressed out, it actually closes its stomata to try to reduce any type of moisture loss, and you want to make sure that you want to get on a different watering schedule. You don't want to stick with the same watering schedule. You want to prepare your trees prior to this heat wave, a few days before. You want to add more water than usual. If you just turn on the water that morning when you know there's a heat wave, most likely the tree is not going to get enough moisture in it to have a fighting chance, pretty much. So you want to be prepared for that. Remember, water before, whitewash young trees as needed. And like I mentioned before, the heat can affect the bloom and fruit set. And for some reason, the summer is coming up earlier in the springtime during that time, and it is getting more intense. So with that, when you have young trees, you want to go ahead and apply the mulch when you can, and also these tensiometers. The avocado growers use these religiously, and it's best that, if you have a new grove or if you want to test these out, these aren't the type that you just leave in the ground and you walk away from. These are manual. They're way cheaper than the ones that you can see through your computer and whatnot. This is just like a general reference. It's always good to have these sorted throughout the grove. And it tells you what the moisture level is within the ground. And there's two levels that you can have it at. Grower versus wildlife. Because we are going through a drought and because there are going to be fires here in Southern California, a lot of wildlife does get displaced. I spoke to a grower who had a young juvenile mountain lion that just wouldn't leave his property. He had to call the game warden and there's certain rules to go by. And usually here in Northern San Diego County, South Riverside County, we get a lot of deer. Of course, because of the drought, they're going to come down to irrigation lines and to reservoirs. And what usually follows behind them? Usually mountain lions. There's been an increase in mountain lion sightings, especially in San Diego County. So we just want to make sure that we're safe out there. We keep an eye out. And also remember, deer can also cause damage and cause prolific damage to younger trees as well. So this grower actually has wire fencing around each little tree and around the trees in general, because most of his trees have been stripped by deer. This is the time when coyote pups are out. So you want to make sure you watch your irrigation lines. I had a grower call me. We were trying to figure out how come his row of trees were dying. There was no pattern, no nothing. It was just a row of trees. And then we found out that most of the irrigation lines that were semi-buried were all chewed up, and it was because of coyotes. Usually from, I don't know, March to late July, the pups are teething. And there's not so much that they need the water, but they like the plastic of it. If you want to know more about coyotes, I would probably contact Neve Quinn. I'm just reporting to you guys what I've been seeing. So just keep an eye out for your rows, your irrigation lines, because the coyotes are out. What I've also heard growers talk about is also the amount of money on labor. This is, you know, especially for the small farms in San Diego County, they have to do most of their own labor, and it's really hard to, one, to find labor, two, to be able to afford labor, and to make sure that the labor gets there on time for them to be able to pick their fruit. Because if not, you wait too long, the fruit can get puffy on the tree and you don't want that. And unfortunately, in 2019, remember, these stats are always going to be a year or two behind. At 11.9, California had the largest percentage of total expenditures. So how much money is basically spent on farms? This is farms in general. And of course, labor took the biggest chunk. And of course, with labor going up, it's becoming something for the growers to be struggling in. And this is also expenditures. We're looking at about 50% of the people that do have farms reply to this request. So this is about 50%. And it seems here that in millions of dollars, that labor once again ends up being the biggest amount of money expenditure that they do have to spend money on. And in 2019, it increased. I'm sure in 2020 and 21, it exceeded that. So expenditures for California in 2019, $610,000 compared with around $500,000 in 2018. It went up. California's total farm production expenditures was $42.7 billion in 2019, a 16% increase from the 2018 estimate of $36.8 billion. So on average, California producers spent the most money on labor, farm services, and feed. Remember, this is going across all type of farms in California. And of course, labor and rent are up there as well from the previous year. And of course, in San Diego, the land is just so expensive now that people are going at a business because, you know, if they don't make their minimum cut when it comes to production, or especially with tree crops, you do have to wait for it to start producing. You can go into debt and buy just rent. That's something that our growers have to deal with. And so we've noticed that we feel like we're losing growers here in Southern California because it's just so expensive to produce. And then with the mandates with the citrus psyllid, the quarantines, it's getting really tough to try to get growers to start growing again in Southern California. So I'm just letting you guys know with that in mind that I am teaching a citrus production course. We have all the topics that you can think of. This year, I changed it. I actually, instead of once a week for 7 weeks, it's twice a week for 8 weeks. And there are two field trips this time for it. And this year I am getting CCA and PCA CEUs for the course. I lowered the price just a little bit so you can get several. I'm trying to think of how many CEUs are in each, but there's a lot of CCAs units with this as well. And they will be held on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 9 a.m. to 11. There are field trips set on the 30th and October 3rd. And let me just show you guys, this is the lineup that we have. So it is going to be a lot of courses, a lot of information. So I wouldn't, if you can join the class, that would be great. We have anyone who's ever worked in citrus within the state. We have Greg from up north. We have my predecessor, Gary Bender. We have Henry Herrera from Cal Fire. We mentioned some stuff about wildfires, especially when we're pertaining to Southern California, what to do before and after a fire, hot pests. So we're thinking of scales, any other type of pests that are out there, which our new farm advisor will be speaking about. We have vertebrate pests, diseases, the two field trips, pruning, how to read water and soil tests. So I highly suggest that, if you can take these courses, I'm also offering them as individual courses as well. So if for some reason you can't attend the entire thing or just want to know about certain topics, then you can go ahead and pick and choose which classes that you want to take.
We put a link to more information on that course in the show notes for today. We have an update on Asian citrus psyllid right after this.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board. Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
On the Citrus Research Board's webinar last week, Dr. Sandeepa Gautam gave an update on the Asian citrus psyllid. She's the assistant research entomologist at the UC Kearney Agricultural Center. Here are her comments.
So let's jump to Asian citrus psyllid now. ACP is a small insect, as small as an aphid. It likes to deposit eggs on the new flush. And flush is the term we hear a lot with ACP and citrus. What it means is it's that new growth that's just coming out, which is very tender and soft and perfect for feeding for insects, sap-sucking insects like Asian citrus psyllid. The Asian citrus psyllid, what it does, the adult finds a growing flush and lays the egg in there. And eggs, when they hatch, they start feeding. The nymphs start feeding on that new flush as it develops and broadens and expands. The nymphs can only survive on the new tender flush. So the adults are, so if you're looking for Acinetricillid, it's best to look in the new flush because that's where they are, that's where all the action is happening. Getting started with the scouting and monitoring, let's first think about what makes ACP move and disperse. Thinking like an ACP, adults can fly, nymph movement is limited. So if adults, you know, decide that they want to fly, they will go find a new new tree or new flush to reproduce and feed on. That may be triggered by disturbance, which could be during the normal operations like harvesting or insecticide application or pruning of the trees that triggers disturbance, and ACP feels like it needs to take off and go find a new tree to land on. Another theory is that after reaching a certain density, ACP will move and find new areas to infest. And we don't really know what that number is, but it's likely that as the population gets dense and dense, the adults tend to move and find newer areas to infest. Another reason might be the availability and the quality of food. Psyllids like soft, tender food. And if there is a new flush on the, you know, like next tree, then they would move to that new flush. And that's how they penetrate from Aces into the orchard. The other way that ACP could move is passive dispersal, when people move psyllids on plants, vehicles, equipments, and bulk surface. And for scouting, there are two methods, passive scouting and active scouting. Passive is using yellow sticky cards to monitor for populations. It is a great tool for monitoring dispersal into newer areas. Because it can be strategically placed along the edges of the grove. It's constantly out there over time, and you can replace it and you can count and you can have an idea of how things are progressing over time. Disadvantage to passive scouting is it's labor intensive. You have to find and replace those traps every week or biweekly, and it can get costly. You also need trained personnel to identify, you know, those people who are looking at the cards to be trained to identify ACPs. And sometimes you might be getting false negatives, meaning that you may not find any adults on the card, but you may have a population in your block. Active scouting is when you are in the grove, actively looking for Acinetricillid. And there are two types. One is visual sampling, that is finding the flush and counting the number of eggs, nymphs, and adults in the flush. You need a hand lens for this because eggs and nymphs are small, harder to see, and they are pretty much tucked. They can be tucked inside that growing flush. Where there is no young flush, another way to sample for adults is using the tap sampling method. And what you do in this is you use a mallet, something that you can tap with, and you pick a branch that's about 1 inch in diameter, and you tap that really hard onto a surface and catch whatever falls of that branch and count the adults. And because of the disturbance, the adults just fall and like to lay there. They're not going to fly, and you can pretty much do the counts. If you're looking for a perfect method, combining passive with active sampling is ideal. You might want to replace the yellow sticky cards biweekly, and based on that number, do the visual sampling when there is flush. Go with the tap sampling method when there is no flush. Always focus on the edges of the grove because that's where ACP likes to hang out before moving on to the interior of the block. And once you do this over many, many seasons, you might get an idea of where in your block ACP starts infesting, and you might identify your hotspot. So it's a good idea to start from your identified hotspot and then move from there. Where ACP is not established, especially in the valley, passive sampling using yellow sticky cards, and whenever there is a find, then you go to visual sampling. The goal for Eastern Citrus Psyllid management, especially for the valley, is to reduce the psyllid and the number of spread of the disease together with the psyllid. Current approach is ACP and HLP quarantine. There are different reasons, zones established based on the ACP find and HLP find, and there are regulations that are required, that the growers are required to spray and then move the fruit between these quarantine zones 14 days before the harvest with an approved insecticide that controls Asian citrus psyllid. Some of these are Danitol, Bathroid, Tombstone, Mustang, Ectara, et cetera. Or another option is to field clean, remove all the stems and leaves and brush and wash the fruit before moving. It's not a very good idea because washing fruit creates other issues with the fruit. Tarping is another regulation that is required. 100% of the citrus load that is traveling between quarantine zones for bulk citrus are required to be tarped. And in future, post-harvest treatment is needed for bulk citrus. And we have worked on evergreen fogging and ethyl formate fumigation, which are very effective options. We evaluated ethyl formate to control ACP in bulk citrus in Riverside in 2019, where what we did is we had the ACP in these modified cases, which were then buried in fruit within all the bins. And then it was tarped with the tarpaulin and fumigated with ethyl formate during 1 hour fumigation at ambient temperature, which was around 60 degrees that day. And we killed all the Asian citrus psyllid. This fumigant, ethyl formate, is in the process of registration and may soon be available as a treatment option. ACP management goals, especially here in the valley, are to prevent ACP coming into the valley. Despite all these regulations, we still see psyllid on trap cuts from time to time, which is shown here on this table. There are some years where we start seeing ACP. I think 2015 is where we start seeing ACP, which triggers eradicative coordinated treatments, which is application of two insecticides during a 30-day interval. It could be two foliar insecticides or foliar followed by a systemic insecticide, which then you would apply immediately after the foliar application, because systemic insecticide takes longer to get absorbed and be, make it to the tree. The eradicative treatment is fairly effective because you see a high population, there is an eradicative treatment that growers are required to treat 800 meters, and you knock that population down. Next year, you don't see ACPs, but then again, it's coming into the valley. In Southern California, growers treat together over a 2 to 3 week window. Usually in fall and winter, that's coordinated by PMAs and pest control districts using the insecticides that have known efficacy against Asian citrus psyllid. In urban areas, in residential and in the household, they release Tamaraxia parasite to control Asian citrus psyllid. And within the HLB quarantine, conventional treatment to keep ACP populations in check.
The CRB webinar series continues today. And for almond growers, the JCS Marketing 2021 Virtual Almond Day is today as well. That's our show for today. If you'd like to send me a comment, you can email me at sabrina@myaglife.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Crew. Thanks for listening.